This is InfoTrack, the weekly show with information you should know. Here's what's happening on this week's show.
The First Amendment, which embodies freedom of speech, is considered one of our nation's most cherished rights. But some say America is on the wrong track and the First Amendment goes too far. We'll have the story.
A lot of it involves uncertainty about what the scope of the First Amendment really looks like and what it means. And then I think also questions about who it applies to.
Then, more kids than ever are playing organized sports. But much of the growth seems to be among the privileged classes.
Playing organized sports became much more common among those of higher family socioeconomic status, in particular having a parent with a college education versus those who did not.
Those two stories and more are coming your way on this edition of InfoTrack. Stay with us. The show begins right after this.
With Progressive's Name Your Price tool, you can easily find coverage options that fit your budget. If only it was that easy to name your baby.
How about Jaden?
No.
Okay, Michael?
Went to middle school with a glue-eating Michael.
Sebastian?
Dated one in college.
How about Damien?
Vampire name.
All right, Greg?
Not feeling it.
Okay, no worries. Jeffrey?
Oh, love that one.
Wait, really?
No.
Find coverage options that fit your budget with Progressive's Name Your Price tool. Get a quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
Get in zone. AutoZone.
Welcome to AutoZone. What are you working on today? Getting ready for more rain and longer nights? We've got you. Right now, you can earn up to $25 in bonus rewards when you buy two Sylvania Silver Star Ultra Bulbs and two Rain-X Quantum Elite Wiper Blades. More rewards and better visibility at America's number one lighting destination, AutoZone.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Offer valid for AutoZone rewards members. Restrictions apply.
Pluto TV is a place for movie fans like me.
And TV fans. Like me.
They've got something for everyone, and it's free.
I love free, and I love Jersey Shore.
For me, it's The Godfather.
SpongeBob SquarePants, I am Patrick. Patrick is me.
Oh, Forrest Gump, come on.
Criminal Minds, solving crime after bedtime.
Whatever you love to watch, Pluto TV makes it easy with thousands of free movies and shows.
Pluto TV, stream now, pay never.
Order for Jennifer C.
Is this my double shot, double cream, double froth, double pump, double hot, double whip, double sleeve?
Yeah. Can you handle that much caffeine?
Hey, did you know Discover automatically doubles all the cash back you've earned at the end of your first year?
Well, I do now.
Seriously, did you know Discover automatically doubles all the cash back you've earned at the end of your first year?
Yeah, you just said that.
Did you say I just said that?
Yeah, I'm cutting you off.
Did you say you're cutting me off?
You earn, we match. Unlimited cash back match. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
InfoTrack, the weekly show with information you should know. Here's your host, Chris Whitting.
Can the First Amendment be used to prohibit hate speech and misinformation? Or does it allow anyone to say anything? It's an ongoing debate. InfoTrack reporter Roy Mackey has the story. Roy?
Thank you, Chris. Keith Whittington is an expert on the U.S. Constitution and is the David Boies Professor at Yale Law School. Professor, in a recent poll, 69% of Americans said they believe the country is on the wrong track in regards to free speech. And 31%, including similar numbers from both political parties, think the First Amendment, quote, goes too far, unquote. What are the most common misconceptions Americans have about the First Amendment today?
Well, a lot of it involves uncertainty about what the scope of the First Amendment really looks like and what it means. And then I think also questions about who it applies to. So when we think about the scope of the First Amendment, you frequently hear now these claims that hate speech, for example, is not free speech, which in many European countries is true, that they don't recognize a free speech protection for things that they categorize as hate speech. That's not true in the United States. In the United States, things that are frequently referred to as hate speech are fully protected by the First Amendment. And at the same time, the First Amendment is not absolute. Threats to other individuals, actual incitement to violence, defamatory speech is all unprotected by the First Amendment. And then there's also questions about who the First Amendment applies to. And in the current context, a lot of people's engagement with the public and speech activities occurs through social media. And of course, social media mostly involves private companies. And private companies can set their own terms and rules about what kind of speech they want to allow on their platforms. That's not true for the government. We tie the hands of the government about what kinds of restrictions on speech they can impose, but we don't tie the hands of social media companies about what kind of speech they can allow on platforms. And so there's something of a disconnect as well for average members of the public about, well, what am I allowed to say in public on a public street, for example, and what am I allowed to say in public in the sense that I say it on a social media platform?
We hear the term misinformation quite often. Can misinformation be prohibited under the First Amendment?
Generally speaking, misinformation is protected. There are some very narrow categories where it might not be. And so this is something that was more of a heated point of discussion in the course of the 20th century. And eventually the court came around to the view that if you empowered the government to suppress what it characterized as misinformation, you would wind up empowering the government to suppress an awful lot of contested political speech. The government would have a self-interest in characterizing things as misinformation that it thought damaging to the government or to government officials and the like, and would tend to suppress it. And so it became seen as crucial that the First Amendment protect so-called misinformation precisely because you couldn't trust government officials to make those decisions about what counted as misinformation and what did not. And so generally speaking, you're allowed to say wrong things in public. You're allowed to say things that you even know are false things in public without worrying that the government's going to punish you for having said those false things.
Professor, we've talked about the fact that the government can't directly suppress speech, but is it permissible for government officials to pressure private companies like social media companies to censor speech?
So it is a real puzzle as to how to think about government pressure. The court is concerned not only in this context, but in other contexts, that the government not be able to do things indirectly that it's not allowed to do directly. And so if the government can't censor speech through its own regulatory behavior, for example, we also do not want the government to put pressure on others to censor the speech on the government's behalf. The real difficult question in practice comes with what counts as pressure. And when are you really compelling some third party, for example, a social media company, to engage in the censorship that you are not allowed to engage in yourself? The challenge as a practical matter is, how do you tell the difference between the government trying to persuade a third party not to do something and the government strong-arming a third party into doing something? And that's not an easy thing to know in lots of circumstances.
We're talking with Professor Keith Whittington from Yale Law School, and we're discussing the state of freedom of speech in America today. Professor, what are your thoughts on the state of civics education today and how that perhaps influences younger people's views of that freedom of speech right?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think we give enough attention to civics education. We don't spend enough time and energy on it in schools, and we could certainly do more. And as a consequence, I think people emerge out of schools not as well educated as they should be about core principles behind our governments, about basic questions about how the government operates and the like. And we could be doing a much better job of trying to explain that to students at an earlier age, so that when they grow up, become full-fledged citizens and are participating in government and participating in the democratic process, they have a better understanding of these things. And among the things we need to be educating them carefully about are First Amendment and free speech principles, both in terms of what First Amendment doctrine actually looks like and what you have a right to do and what do you not have a right to do under the First Amendment. I think we also need to be, as part of that process, explaining why the First Amendment doctrine looks the way it does. Why do we protect this kind of speech? And why do we not protect other kinds of speech? That is part of how you have well-informed citizens who are capable of making better decisions in a democracy. And so we need to be starting that at an early age and try to put people on the right track as they think about those issues. But I think we have not spent enough time on those. We've reduced the amount of time we dedicate to civics education, and we really probably don't explore these issues with the kind of depth and care in schools that we really ought to.
So a final thought on striking the balance. How do we protect vulnerable people and counter false information while protecting people's right to free speech?
Well, we've made a very basic bet in a free society that we are better off as a society in the long term if we provide very robust protections for speech, including all kinds of speech that is sometimes genuinely harmful. And so we shouldn't pretend that there's not some trade-offs involved, and we shouldn't pretend that there aren't sometimes harms to allowing particular examples of speech to take place. The question is, are we better off tolerating those kinds of problems with a free speech environment, or would we be better off trying to suppress speech under those circumstances? And I think we should be clear-eyed that we are making trade-offs, but at the same time, I think we should appreciate the fact that if we empower government officials to be able to make those decisions, that some kind of speech that is offensive or that some people find too harmful can be suppressed, that's going to lead to a lot of speech suppression. And moreover, the people who are going to be targets of that speech suppression are precisely often the marginalized populations that we otherwise say we're concerned about. It's the people without a lot of political power who are going to find themselves in the crosshairs of a government that is empowered to suppress speech that people regard as controversial or dangerous. And so I think in the long run, the best way of protecting marginalized populations within a free society is precisely to insist that we're going to have very robust protections on free speech that everyone can take advantage of and engage in. And we're not going to trust government officials to be able to pick and choose which kinds of speech they approve of and which kinds of speech they disapprove.
Professor Keith Whittington from Yale Law School, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And for InfoTrack, I'm Roy Mackey.
Next, are organized sports mostly for upper-class kids? That story, coming up.
Stick around. There's more InfoTrack straight ahead. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds, which could be life-changing. I mean, you could put that money towards concert tickets for your daughter to see that singer who sings about painful breakups. And one song will inspire your little beauty to break up with that beast she's dating, Brian. Instead, she'll date someone who's nice and worthy of her love, not someone who addresses you and your spouse as, bro. And it's all because you could save money switching at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, not available in all states.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Welcome to AutoZone. What are you working on today? Ah, sounds like wipers. If your wipers are streaking, skipping, chattering, or even worse, loud, you need to visit AutoZone and get some fresh new blades. We've got basic wipers to get you back on the road, as well as premium blades from Bosch and Rain-X. So if you're hearing this, just head to your nearest AutoZone or AutoZone.com.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Pluto TV is a place for movie fans like me.
And TV fans like me.
They've got something for everyone, and it's free.
I love free, and I love Jersey Shore.
For me, it's The Godfather.
SpongeBob SquarePants, I am Patrick. Patrick is me.
Oh, Forrest Gump, come on.
Criminal Minds, solving crime after bedtime.
Whatever you love to watch, Pluto TV makes it easy with thousands of free movies and shows.
Pluto TV, stream now, pay never.
Did you know that Wendy's has any size soft drinks for just a buck? Yeah, any size, anytime. Like a dollar Coke, dollar Sprite, or even a dollar Strawberry Fanta. Okay, could we like maybe switch up the sound effect, please? Because I'm losing it. Wow, no, not that. Any size soft drink for just a buck? Gotta be Wendy's.
Limited time only. Price and participation may vary. A la carte only. Not valid in a combo. Exclusions apply.
Now, InfoTrack continues. Once again, here's Chris Whitting.
A major U.S. study of youth sports participation over six decades noted a significant increase in kids playing organized sports, especially among more privileged, educated families. Joining us to discuss this study is Chris Knuster, professor of sociology at The Ohio State University and lead author of the study. Professor, what inspired this sweeping study of U.S. sports participation among the young over the past 60 years?
Well, as a parent, the way that young people were taking part in sports these days are remarkably different than what many of us grew up with generations ago. And so we had the opportunity to collect some unique information, data from 4,000 adults spanning from being born in the 1950s through the 1990s, and trace their experiences with youth sports.
How have class differences in sports participation evolved from the 50s to the 90s?
Well, we saw a couple of patterns of note that pertain to that. First, there's just been a general generational shift from about roughly 50% of all youth participating in organized sport at some time while growing up to about 70% participating. So much more common today and an integral part of youth experiences. But to your inquiry, one of the more dramatic shifts within that broad generational change is that playing organized sports became much more common among those of higher family socioeconomic status. In particular, having a parent with a college education versus having no parent with a college education is a major determining factor. So in the 1960s, you know, for those folks who were born in the 1950s, we didn't really see social class differences to speak of. But now, what has transpired in the 21st century, even with the folks born in the 1990s, there's about a 24 percentage point difference between those who had a college-educated parent versus those who did not.
Your study mentions increased privatization of youth sports. Can you explain what that means and how it affects participation?
What seems to be going on as part of the social class divergence, and particularly a boost in playing amongst those with college-educated and wealthier parents, is that those parents have really taken on what seem to be cultural expectations and pressures for intensive parenting, doing more and more for their kids. So that's a lost opportunity if you're not investing in those kids' opportunities for growth, whether it's, you know, mental growth or physical growth. Youth sports is thought of as a particularly useful developmental experience for kids. And so having the opportunities of time, of being able to handle transportation, be able to seek out preferable opportunities are all linked to family socioeconomic status. And of course, most obviously to the question about privatization, is that the costs of youth sports have particularly become a greater barrier for people who are looking for what is thought to be the preferred expert-oriented training opportunities. And we've seen a big growth of that in the landscape of youth sports, and particularly well-educated and wealthier parents have sought those out.
Professor, there was a previous study that showed kids dropping out of sports because they weren't having fun. Do you think this issue has gotten worse for recent generations?
Absolutely, and that's something that our study speaks to as well. Amongst the folks that played organized sports, we find evidence that approximately two-thirds of them now drop out, which is actually an increase from what we've seen 50 plus years ago, too. So part of the story of the growth in exposure to organized youth sports is that we haven't really seen much change, certainly not increase. In fact, there's some evidence from our study of some decrease in the percentage of kids who continually play organized youth sports. That is, from the time they start till they hit the age of 18. Instead, what has accompanied that growth in exposure to organized youth sports is an increase then of the folks who start to play but then drop out. And so we provide some of the best evidence of what people have expressed as a major alarm in how we're doing youth sports. That is, people don't seem to stick with it.
Now, the study indicates that youth sports has perhaps become more about getting ahead in life rather than just enjoyment. How do you view that shift?
Yeah, so absolutely. I think that speaks to why we've seen these emergent socioeconomic status differences. In part, organized youth sport is seen as an investment in many ways in a child's future, whether it's, you know, the potential of the scholarship opportunities or playing at a high level of sport, whether it's building one's resume, whether it's health and well-being outcomes or other social development benefits of interacting with other people. And so largely what we've seen there is a focus on investing in kids. And the broader context of that, too, is that organized youth sports has become a much more competitive and status-focused landscape. And so in that realm, we've had parents get particularly involved and overinvested in what happens. We've had kids who express, you know, really a lot of stress and worry about being in situations where they feel like they're under too much pressure or they'd rather not be there, but feel like because of the investments, that's part of what's expected of them. And I think that environment that is less focused on nurturing fun and social relationships and more focused on status focus and particularly athletic growth and development. As part of the story here where we're seeing, you know, roughly two-thirds to 70% of youth dropping out of organized sports.
Our guest is Chris Knuster, who's professor of sociology at The Ohio State University and lead author of this study we're discussing about youth sports participation over six decades. You touched on the financial side of this equation, and I have here a statistic that the average family spends $883 annually for one child's primary sport. This has got to affect low-income families in a dramatic way, I would think.
Absolutely. And I would say that's certainly a pretty remarkable statistic, but it's also important to recognize that that's an average statistic. Part of our related research that we've been tracing here is not only the rise of organized youth sports, but particularly, you know, what's known as travel or club sports. And, you know, it's not uncommon for those to be 3 to 10 times the annual price point that you mentioned.
Wow.
And so in this context, of course, it's an enormous investment, an enormous barrier to many families to put forth the fees and related expenses that particularly privatized organized youth sports require these days.
Is this something where a government policy or perhaps support from the government would help the situation, or is that just really not going to happen?
Well, absolutely. There's a number of things I think to be mindful of. You know, I hearken back to comments about the experiences that kids were having were such that, you know, we're not optimizing keeping as many kids involved as possible. The structures of how we've organized youth sports are largely competence-based in addition to financially based. And so, you know, if you don't reach the threshold of ability, in addition to reach those threshold of being able to afford it, oftentimes you're discouraged, if not outright prevented from playing in many sport leagues or for particular teams. But to your point, we should think more strategically at various levels, certainly community and statewide and national, even global. If we recognize that youth sports opportunities, in particular organized youth sports per conversation, can offer some important benefits, including health and well-being. With that in mind, it does make a lot of sense to work together to reduce those costs and to promote and afford more kids with an opportunity, but also a positive environment for staying active and having fun and interacting with other people that allows them to nurture relationships with. And so certainly whatever funding source we talk about, I think there's good reason to share the burden of that cost and not rely on a single family to invest everything that they have, really, in order to promote their child's sport participation.
Chris Knuster, professor of sociology at The Ohio State University on youth sports participation. Professor, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to InfoTrack, a production of Syndication Networks. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds, which could be life-changing. I mean, you could put that money towards that zero-turn lawnmower you've always wanted. And after using its edge-shaping technology to meticulously sculpt the face of the Mona Lisa into your grass, you'll become the undisputed king of Saturday morning lawn care, leaving your neighbor and sworn enemy Gary to question his place in the delicate neighborhood ecosystem. And it's all because you could save money switching at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, not available in all states.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Welcome to AutoZone. What are you working on today? Getting ready for more rain and longer nights? We've got you. Right now, you can earn up to $25 in bonus rewards when you buy two Sylvania Silver Star Ultra Bulbs and two Rain-X Quantum Elite Wiper Blades. More rewards and better visibility at America's number one lighting destination, AutoZone.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Offer valid for AutoZone Rewards members. Restrictions apply.
Recent research reveals a disturbing trend. Men who live in rural areas are less healthy and often die earlier than urban men. What are the reasons and how can this trend be prevented? InfoTrack reporter Gina Tedesco joins us with the details. Gina?
Thanks, Chris. Joining us now is Jack Chappell, postdoctoral scholar at the USC Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics. Your study found that 60-year-old rural men can now expect to live 2 years less than their urban counterparts, and that disparity is nearly three times higher than two decades ago. First of all, can you characterize your level of concern about this?
Yeah, we were expecting there to be somewhat of a disparity in life expectancy, because previous studies have also found this. But I was a bit surprised by just how large the gap was, especially for men, which points to potential difficulty in fully addressing this gap in the future. And I think this is especially alarming for rural areas because this points to a rising demand for care, which will be particularly challenging for these communities, since rural areas tend to have shortages of healthcare providers and slightly older populations. If we have an aging population with more health conditions and fewer people to care for those older people with more conditions, this issue is set to grow.
And you've hinted at it, but although your study looked at rural men, is it fair to extrapolate and say rural women are also at risk of dying earlier than their urban counterparts?
Yeah, definitely. So we did see meaningful differences in healthy life expectancy for women as well. But just when we compare to the size of the gap that we saw for men, it was just not quite as large, but still meaningful.
And what did you find about the rural men's quality of health compared to urban men of the same age?
We found that rural men had higher rates of smoking, higher rates of disability, and more often had multiple chronic conditions. These differences for rural and urban men were a little bit larger than for rural versus urban women. And so the underlying reasons for these differences in health status at age 60 are a little bit less clear, but definitely warrant more research. But we can speculate on some of these potential reasons. So one might be related to structural economic issues that can impact health, and it might be that these issues impact men more. So for example, higher rates of disability might be due to increased occupational risks and jobs more often held by rural men, such as manufacturing or mining. Or it could also be the shifts in rural jobs away from declining industries such as mining and towards more service or seasonal work might lead to more joblessness and reduced income for men, which might produce stress and create some additional compounding issues on the health issues that we identify.
And why are there shortages of healthcare providers and potential caregivers in rural areas?
Yeah, so with just a less dense population, it's a little bit harder to have the kinds of economies of scale that are required to operate hospitals or health clinics. And so we tend to see shortages of healthcare providers in these areas. And it's difficult to incentivize more providers to stay located there. And so we often see people moving closer to where there's more population and just more people to care for.
We're visiting with Jack Chappell, postdoctoral scholar at the USC Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics. Their study on shorter life expectancy for rural people is published in the Journal of Rural Health. We talked a moment ago about rural women also living a shorter lifespan than urban women, but the gap is much smaller than men. Why are the women doing better?
The simple answer is just that we see just a smaller gap in things like disability and smoking. And so we're not totally sure on why that is. It might be kind of related to the things I was saying before about economic circumstances that might be harder for men than for women when we compare between rural and urban areas.
Are rural residents less likely to have health insurance than urban residents? And could this be a factor?
Rates of health insurance are a little bit lower in rural areas, and there's a few potential reasons for that. One might just be that it's a little bit harder to operate the health insurance programs when there's less people and less of a base of people to contribute money into the insurance system. And so some policies that might help address that is if the 10 states that have not expanded Medicaid yet were to expand Medicaid to include eligibility for all low-income people, I think that would definitely help increase access to insurance in rural areas in particular.
Jack Chappell, I want to thank you so much for joining us and sharing your study.
Great, thanks for having me.
For InfoTrack, I'm Gina Tedesco.
That wraps up another edition of InfoTrack. Our executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm your host, Chris Whitting, inviting you to join us next week for another edition of InfoTrack.
get to know us.
I wouldn't miss it for the world.
Learn more about Mike, Laura, Aaron, and Jay at WCFW.FM. Plus, listen to the daily news roundup for Eau Claire.
Sign up for our free newsletter and more
online at WCFW.FM.
Kamala Harris gets that everyday costs are too high. She has real plans to tackle price gouging, cut taxes for middle-class families, and make life more affordable. Her opponent's plan?
Donald Trump plans to impose what is, in effect, a national sales tax. On everyday products, it will mean higher prices on just about every one of your daily needs. A Trump tax on gas, a Trump tax on food, a Trump tax on clothing, a Trump tax on over-the-counter medication. Donald Trump's plan would cost a typical family $3,900 a year. When everyday prices are too high, he will make them even higher.
Kamala Harris, a better plan for lowering costs for a future we can afford. Paid for by FFPAC, FFPAC.org. Not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee. FFPAC's responsible for the content of this advertising.
Living on a fixed income isn't easy. Today I have to get some groceries. Oh, and I need new light bulbs and trash bags. I need to stop by the pharmacy to fill my prescriptions. And I was going to get a birthday present for my granddaughter. Trump's import tax will cost us almost $4,000 more a year for these errands. Kamala Harris is cracking down on price gouging for groceries, and she will always protect our Social Security benefits from Trump's plans to make cuts.
After years of hard work, you should be able to retire with dignity. We capped the price of insulin at $35 a month and the total cost of prescription drugs at $2,000 a year for seniors.
Learn more at thetrumptax.com. Paid for by voters of these 50 states. Votersofthese50states.com. Voters of these 50 states is responsible for the content of this advertising, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.
CFW.
1057 CFW. And more.
105.7 CFW.
We'll be singing when we're winning. We'll be singing.
I get no doubt. lover's me. Can you, my darling, can you picture this?
Dream if you can,
a courtyard, an ocean of violets in bloom. Animals strike curious poses. They feel the heat between me and you.
Just leave me standing alone in a world that's so cold. Maybe I'm just too demanding. Maybe I'm just like my father, too bold. Maybe you're just like my mother. She's never
McKay is back. Wake up with Mike McKay in the morning every weekday morning from 6 till 10 on CFW. Mike has your news and weather every hour and everything you need to know about the fun things happening throughout Eau Claire and the entire Chippewa Valley. Plus, Mike announces your birthday and anniversary shout-outs every morning at 8:15. Send them in through our Facebook or text us. It's easy to do with our free Civic Media app.
Listen in the morning and it'll keep you smiling all day.
Mike McKay in the morning on 105.7 CFW.
This is an important announcement for Wisconsinites who plan to vote in the November 2024 election. Leading nonpartisan economists have analyzed the economic plans of Donald Trump and concluded that he would cause inflation to rise and the economy to slow. And 16 Nobel Prize-winning economists wrote a letter warning that Donald Trump would reignite inflation with his fiscally irresponsible budgets. Donald Trump's tariff plan would act as a national sales tax, costing the average family as much as $4,000 per year. But Vice President Kamala Harris's plan would help middle-class families deal with rising costs. In her first 100 days, Kamala Harris would pass a ban on price gouging at the grocery store. And as vice president, she worked to cap the cost of many prescription drugs, including insulin, saving many families thousands of dollars per year. On the economy, the choice is clear. Vote Kamala Harris for president. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together Action, www.abwt-action.org. Not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.
Todd Albaugh.
Former Senate Majority Leader for the state of Wisconsin, Republican Dale Schultz, you are endorsing Kamala Harris and Tim Walz for President and Vice President of the United States, respectively.
It's time to stand up and point out to people that
Donald Trump should never, ever, ever be allowed anywhere near power, because the lack of humanity is just that significant. People need to know they can count on their leaders. And I'd like to point out Liz Cheney has made the same comment. I'm just proud of the fact that Liz Cheney right away stood up and said, this is probably one of the most important things I'll ever do. A real inspiration and a real leader.
And I think there's a lot of folks out there who are like, you know what? I'm still a Republican.
It's okay to sometimes be an American before you are a partisan.
Hear more of the Todd Albaugh Show on 93.5 FM, The Tap, or live with the Civic Media app, weekdays noon to 2.
Wisconsin has many state symbols, but did you know there's an official ballad?
Oh, Wisconsin, land of my dreams.
Oh, Wisconsin, land of my dreams, composed by Sherry Sarazin.
I don't think it was an hour, and I had the music matched up.
With long-ago help from her grandmother.
She wrote a poem in the late 1920s about where she lived in Wisconsin.
And it's now the state ballad. So are these also official Wisconsin symbols? The Kringle, Wood Violet, American Water Spaniel? The answer coming up. The official process can take years and includes advocating the legislature to make it law. Now, along with the official ballad, are the Kringle, Wood Violet, and American Water Spaniel also state symbols? Yes, each is a celebration of the state and a slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
For WCFW News, I'm James Kelly. With the general election just days away, Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump will hold competing rallies in Wisconsin. Both Vice President Harris and former President Trump are scheduled to hold rallies in the Milwaukee area on Friday, just a few miles away from each other. The Milwaukee area is crucial for both candidates to win the swing state, as most recent presidential elections in the state have been decided by less than 23,000 votes. Trump will return to Fiserv Forum, while Harris will visit the State Fair Park. If you want to vote early in Wisconsin but still haven't done it yet, your window is rapidly closing. The final day for in-person early voting in most communities is Friday, unless your municipality offers early voting over the weekend. There will be no in-person early voting anywhere in Wisconsin on Monday to give election workers the time they need to prepare for Election Day. For details on when in-person early voting will be offered in your area, you should check with your local clerk. If you can't vote early over the weekend, you'll have to wait for Tuesday. The Wisconsin Department of Transportation has announced new plans to replace nearly 16 miles of highway between Cadott and Cornell. According to DOT officials, the project is currently planned for 2027 and would replace 15.5 miles of Highway 27. The project is expected to cost between $8 and $9 million. It would involve resurfacing the road, replacing a pedestrian underpass in Cadott, and completing work on the Yellow River Bridge. DOT officials will host a public hearing on the future project on November 13th at the Cadott Elementary School. Eau Claire residents will need to start remembering where their car is parked starting this week. The city of Eau Claire is reminding residents that alternate side parking will go back into effect beginning at midnight on November 1st. While alternate side parking is in effect, residents will need to park their cars on the odd-numbered side of the street on odd dates and the even side of the street on even dates. The alternate side parking will allow city officials to clear snow off the roads faster and improve safety. Alternate side parking will end on May 1st. For WCFW News, I'm James Kelly.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Rain and breezy conditions expected today. High temperatures warming to the lower 50s. That southeast wind up around 30 miles per hour. Possibility of some heavy rainfall tonight into your Sunday and Monday. Temperatures on the rise overnight.
Currently 46 degrees.
CFW.
We'll be right back.
90s.
Baby, one more time.
And more. 105.7 CFW.